And a Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, this is your percipiently genial host, John Derbyshire, with the week's roundup. I'm broadcasting to you from Radio Derb's state-of-the-art sound studio here in the sunny Aegean, courtesy of Taki's magazine. Things are getting a little rough here in Greece, let me tell you. Here on the island, we're pretty much reduced to a barter economy. This is somewhat hard on yours truly, as I didn't bring much with me from New York, so I'm short of stuff to barter. I was worried that my research assistants, Mandy, Candy and Brandy, might be in the same unfortunate situation, but they seem to be doing surprisingly well. Mandy is driving a rather nice late-model sports car. Candy has acquired a jet ski somehow, and Brandy showed up at last week's post-broadcast party flashing some very expensive-looking jewellery. I guess some people are just better at bartering than others. I can't think of any other explanation. OK, here's the week's news, or as much of it as a normal human soul can bear. Recent news has been dominated by angry Muslims. What are they angry about? A movie, that's what. Or rather, a movie trailer, as the actual movie may or may not exist. The trailer for this movie that may or may not exist gives the movie title as Innocence of Muslims. Put that into the YouTube search box and you can see the trailer for yourself. It's 13 minutes, 51 seconds. And personally, having watched all 13 minutes, 51 seconds of the thing, I weep for that much time lost from my life that I shall never get back. Yes, the clip is irredeemably awful. I heard people saying this before I watched the thing myself. I thought they were just doing some politically correct positioning. You know, I'm all for freedom of speech, but this is too much. But no, it really is awful. If you want to watch an anti-Islam movie, one made with skill and professionalism, try Fitna, F-I-T-N-A. It's only a bit longer, 17 minutes, and much better. Anyway, some guy in California made this movie, or movie clip, and Terry Jones, the eccentric preacher down in Gainesville, Florida, who burned a Quran in his church last year, Terry Jones has been promoting it. Who is the guy who made the movie? That's an interesting question. It seems highly likely that the movie maker is a Copt living in Cerritos, California. The Copts, just to remind you, are the Christians of Egypt. If you remember your Gibbon, you'll know that Egypt was a big centre of Christianity before the Muslim expansion of the 7th century. Well, the Copts are the remnant of Egyptian Christianity, descendants of that minority of Egyptians who didn't convert to Islam. They're usually quoted at 10% of modern Egypt's population, although both Copts and Muslim Egyptians will give you an argument about that. They've suffered some disabilities and discrimination in modern Egypt, the more so since this new Islamic government took power. Okay, so this Coptic guy in California, whose name, by the way, is either Nakula Nakula or Mark Baselli Youssef, or Youssef M. Baselli, or Sam Bassel, or Sam Basile. It's all a bit murky. This guy made a quite amazingly bad movie clip that is obviously intended to put Islam and Mohammed in a bad light. and Pastor Terry Jones is helping to promote it. And Muslims are mad, real mad. Extreme movie criticism, you might call it. For some reason, don't ask me, the Muslims of North Africa are especially mad. I suppose at some level they're mad at Sam Bassel, or Nakula Nakula, or whatever his name is. And perhaps at Terry Jones too. This is the world of the Muslim Arabs, however, in which everything that happens is plotted in advance by the great Satan, America. So, off the angry Muslims went to attack US embassies and consulates. Hundreds of protesters marched through Cairo, the capital of Egypt. Just to remind you, Egypt is the recipient of $1.5 billion in foreign aid every year. Originally a bribe for them to make peace with Israel, but now a permanent fixture in the US national budget. So here's this mob marching on the US embassy in Cairo. They climbed the wall, pulled down the US flag, and tried to burn it. This proved to be beyond their abilities, so they just tore it up and tried to raise an Islamic flag instead. The Cairo police, in their uniforms paid for by you and me, and carrying weapons paid for by you and me, the police did nothing. The worst attack was in the Libyan city of Benghazi. Benghazi not being the capital of Libya, it doesn't have an embassy, only a consulate. The US ambassador, Christopher Stevens, was in that consulate, though. The mob attacked and set fire to the place, and Ambassador Stevens and three other Americans were killed. The attack on the Benghazi consulate looks a little too well organised to have been just an out-of-control mob demonstrating against a movie. The currently popular theory among security specialists who get quoted by the newspapers is that Al-Qaeda, or one of their affiliates, organised the attack using the rock-throwing movie critics as cover. Al-Qaeda CEO Ayman al-Zawahiri is ticked off because we just recently whacked his number two man in Pakistan using a drone. And hey, it's 9/11. In situations like this, people always want to know why the embassy or consulate isn't better able to defend itself. Well, it's a tricky thing. The State Department runs an outfit called the Diplomatic Security Service, whose agents are armed and posted at our missions. The US Marine Corps also runs a section called Marine Security Guards, MSGs, who operate in our diplomatic compounds. Well, they operate in some of them at the discretion of the State Department Security Officer for each region. We now know that there were no MSGs at the Benghazi consulate. In any case, none of these units is heavily armed. It's just sidearms and shotguns, backed up with pepper spray, tear gas, and maybe some crowd control rubber baton rounds. The philosophy is that mission staff need to be able to cope with small-scale security emergencies. You know, some nutcase going berserk in the visa section, that sort of thing. Anything much above that is the responsibility of the host government's own law enforcement people. The responsibility of the host government to protect foreign missions is taken very seriously indeed by diplomats and governments everywhere. If the host government fails in that responsibility, that can be taken as a hostile act. It might not rise to the level of a casus belli, but it sure calls for some major apologising, at the very least, maybe reparations. These are the fundamentals of international intercourse. They are, in fact, even more fundamental than that. Before there were nations, these were the rules of tribal intercourse. If you don't want to be raiding and fighting all the time, you have to be able to send people to discuss things with the other tribe's chiefs. And those people, those ambassadors, need some basic protections and immunities. There is hardly anything more fundamental than this in the human world. If we let go of these basics, we're in a realm of chaos. Do America's leaders understand this? It's not clear that they do. America's current leaders grew up steeped in the countercultural ethos of the 1960s and 1970s. Their instinctive reaction to any international incident is to assume that America must be in the wrong. Not them, of course, not their America. The wrong must have been done by the other America. The America where dumb hicks cling to their guns and Bibles. The America of racist xenophobes who do not understand that one religion is just as good as another. And that when foreigners' anger is directed at us, it's no more than we deserve for our historical sins. That would be the America of people like, Terry Jones. So, the news from Libya sent the Obamaroids into full cringe mode. Our diplomats in Egypt, having watched the unrestrained mob tear up their country's flag, put out a whimpering statement that said, edited quote, "The Embassy of the United States in Cairo condemns the continuing efforts by misguided individuals to hurt the religious feelings of Muslims, as we condemn efforts to offend believers of all religions. Respect for religious beliefs is a cornerstone of American democracy. We firmly reject the actions by those who abuse the universal right of free speech to hurt the religious beliefs of others." End quote. That sounds to me, and I bet it sounds to the Islamist nutsos, very much like an apology. What are they apologising for? These are the accredited representatives of the USA. The USA didn't do anything wrong. It didn't do anything to, quote, hurt the religious feelings of Muslims. Poor things. Individual Americans may have done dumb, stupid, or offensive things, but that's their right as free citizens of a free nation. And if our diplomats want to say anything, they should damn well stand up for those rights. In fact, the US Embassy was not required to say anything, and would have been wiser to say nothing. The impulse to grovel and apologise is just too strong in these boomer lefties, though. They can't help themselves. Mitt Romney had this to say Tuesday night, quote, "I'm outraged by the attacks on American diplomatic missions in Libya and Egypt, and by the death of an American consulate worker in Benghazi. It's disgraceful that the Obama administration's first response was not to condemn attacks on our diplomatic missions, but to sympathise with those who waged the attacks." End quote from Mitt. That sounds right to me. Barack Obama, though, since I was speaking of American officials steeped in boomer leftism, Barack Obama took umbrage, or pretended to, and his media poodles piled on. It is now received wisdom that Romney made a monstrous gaffe, when all he actually did was to notice how the administration was bowing and scraping to savages. And here's another boomer lefty, Mrs. Clinton, our Secretary of State, whimpering that, quote, "I asked myself, how could this happen? How could this happen in a country we helped liberate? In a city we helped save from destruction?" End of whimpering quote. For goodness sake, get a clue, Madam Secretary. In that part of the world, when you help people who hate you, they don't drop the hatred, they just fortify it with contempt. Contempt for fools whose heads are full of sanctimonious illusions. Later, Mrs. Clinton weaseled that Sam Bassel's film is, quote, "disgusting and reprehensible." What if it is, you half-wit failed lawyer, who'd be serving up high school lunches if you'd married a different guy? What if it is? It's a private production by private citizens. None of your damn business. Stop apologising to people who hate us. Now, smelling our weakness the way dogs smell fear, smelling our willingness to grovel and beg and blame our own people, crazy Muslims all over the world are marching on our embassies. Tunisia, Yemen, Bangladesh. I'm losing track. We'll be lucky to get out of this without losing more diplomats. And Mitt Romney's a villain here? I'm no great Romney fan, but at least the guy stood up for his country. Indulge me, please, listeners. I'm going to do a thing I very rarely do. I'm going to play an entire clip from a previous Radio Der broadcast. This one went on the air somewhat over a year ago, August 26th, 2011. Here it is, and I stand by every word. I see that Radio Derb has held off commenting on the ructions in Libya. The reason is pretty simple. I don't give a fig about Libya. How is Libya important to me as an American? It isn't, and if we're spending $1 from the national fisc trying to affect events in Libya, that's $1 too much. I also think we've behaved badly towards Muammar Gaddafi. That isn't such an awful thing to do, since Gaddafi is a loathsome psychopath. Still, there are right and wrong kinds of behaviour, even when dealing with loathsome psychopaths, and ours has been mostly wrong. Consider our past exchanges with Gaddafi. In April 1986, Libyan agents bombed a nightclub in Berlin, killing two US servicemen and injuring 80 more, leaving some permanently disabled. In retaliation, the Reagan administration bombed Libya 9 days later. Number of casualties unknown, but probably commensurate with the number in Berlin. In retaliation for that, 2.5 years later, the Libyans brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, with 270 fatalities, 190 of them American. The bombing was found to be the work of Libyan state agents, undoubtedly under orders from Gaddafi. At that point, i.e. in 1991, the US government would, in my opinion, have been entirely justified in sending an expeditionary force to invade Libya and reduce its towns, cities, military and commercial establishments and communication facilities to heaps of trash. Not only would we have been justified in doing that, we should have done it. Libya had made war against us, indiscriminate war against both our military and civilian populations. And we should have made war right back, with 10,000 times as much force. I venture to speculate that if we had delivered such a salutary lesson in 1991, there would have been no 9/11. As the late Osama bin Laden expressed the Arab point of view so eloquently, if people see a weak horse and a strong horse, naturally they will favour the strong horse.
We did not go to war against Libya, though. In deference to the oil companies, we cut a deal with Gaddafi and effectively forgave him his sins, accepting blood money from him, most of it squeezed by Gaddafi from those same oil companies, and granting him immunity from prosecutions. When we invaded Iraq in 2003, Gaddafi suspected he might be next. He thereupon got real nice with us, forsaking his primitive nuclear program and offering intelligence assistance in the war on terror. For this, we fully accepted him, and pretty soon he was exchanging smiling handshakes with Tony Blair, Condi Rice, John McCain, and, oh yes, Barack Obama. All right, international politics has its own logic, and it's not a Girl Scout clambake. If Roosevelt and Churchill could pal up with Joe Stalin, I guess we could do photo ops with Gaddafi. But then, when Gaddafi's domestic situation goes pear-shaped on him, suddenly he's a limb of Satan again, and we're making righteous war against him. I'm sorry, but that's just kicking a man when he's down. Decent people don't do that, not even to grossly indecent opponents. Having kissed and made up with Gaddafi and accepted his assistance, however grudging and dubious, we should have stood by him, or at least left him alone to deal with his domestic problems as best he might. The NATO campaign against Libya is an act of hypocrisy. In the case of some of the actors, hoping for oil favours from the victorious rebels, it's opportunistic, which is at least understandable. In the case of the US, it's pure, useless, expensive, counterproductive sanctimony. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. In fact, we ought to be twice ashamed for not having hammered Gaddafi when we ought 20 years ago, and for hammering him now when we ought not. The French and Italians are at least looking to make money out of the operation. We just did it because it felt good. Not even for grown-up commercial reasons, but for shallow and silly emotional reasons. For shame, for shame.
The other big news story this past week has been the Chicago public school teachers coming out on strike. I know it's wicked of me, but any kind of education story gets me heading straight for the demographic databases. Here I see that the ethnic breakdown of students in Chicago public schools is 44% Hispanic, 42% Black, 9% non-Hispanic white, and the rest mostly Asian. A paltry 9% whites is a bit peculiar, as the actual city of Chicago is 32% non-Hispanic whites. I guess Chicago whites don't like their public schools. Chicago's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, sure doesn't. His own three kids are privately educated. Chicago public school teachers are considerably whiter than their students. 50% of them are white. I don't tell you this gratuitously, but because I think it offers some clues about what's going on in this strike. You see, Chicago public school teachers have a pretty nice deal. They have an average salary of $76,000 a year. A Chicago police officer needs 4.5 years of service to earn that much, and his job is full-time. The median salary for corrections officers in Chicago is $42,197, and again, that's full-time. The median income for all full-time workers in Chicago, from bus drivers to bond traders, is $49,000. And of course, Chicago teachers have great benefits, pensions and so on. They should be a really happy lot. Why are they striking? Not only are the teachers doing well, their union's doing pretty well too. It pulls in $30 million a year from member dues. Union President Karen Lewis, who has a long paper trail as a radical left activist, keeps her compensation a closely guarded secret. But from what we can piece together, it looks like at least $250,000 a year. Yes, folks, we're in the territory of big money public sector employees here. The money was set to get even bigger, too. The deal that they're striking over offered them a 16% raise. That would be more than $12,000 on that $76,000 annual average salary. Did you get any $12,000 raises recently, listener? Me neither. So, let me ask again, what are they striking for? NBC News, in a report on Tuesday this week, got to the heart of the matter. There is a nationwide movement on to pay good teachers more and bad teachers less. Pretty uncontroversial, you might think. But how do you separate the sheep from the goats? How do you know who's a good teacher and who's a bad teacher? Well, education bureaucrats and politicians have settled on this idea. You assess a teacher by the performance of students on standardized tests. Again, pretty uncontroversial, surely. Well, no. Quote from that NBC report, quote, "With negotiators trying to hammer out an agreement that would end Chicago's teachers' strike, one of the key sticking points is how to evaluate whether a teacher is doing a good job, an issue that has riled school boards across the US in recent years. Chicago's school leaders are proposing that student performance on standardized tests count toward 25% of a teacher's assessment, growing to 40% in 5 years. Why is this a, quote, key sticking point? For the same reason, Chicago's white citizens have fled the public schools. For the same reason that a city that's 32% white has a public school student body that's only 9% white. Because not much learning goes on in those schools. If teachers are evaluated according to how much learning's going on, they're not going to be evaluated well, and their pay and promotions will suffer. You see, it's all down to demographics. I tell you, education and demographics go together like soup and salad. And you should thank me for telling you this, because nobody else will. The poor old US economy is still bumping along the bottom. Last Friday's jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that 96,000 jobs were created in August. Sounds nice, except that the forecast had been for 130,000. We further learn that nearly four times that number of people, that's 370,000, dropped out of the workforce in August. This has the statistical benefit of lowering the unemployment rate, but that's a bit like lowering your debts by shooting your creditors. And, of course, the one thing you never read about on the business pages, let alone in the main news stories, that 96,000 jobs created is a smaller number than the 100,000 work permits a month handed out to new immigrants under our clinically insane immigration policy. Pat Buchanan has suggested a total moratorium on immigration until the unemployment rate drops below 6%. But hey, Pat Buchanan's a crazy old reactionary, so who cares about him? In the longer term, things look even more dismal. Reports of the death of American manufacturing are greatly exaggerated. We are in fact the world's number one manufacturer. However, there are now the same number of people working in manufacturing in the USA as there were at the end of the Depression, even though the population is more than twice as big. The last decade, from 1999 to 2009, was particularly hard on manufacturing jobs. So, what kind of jobs are being created? Well, practically all the jobs created in the last decade were in local businesses, government, healthcare, retailing, and food service, according to Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter. 40 million Americans have no higher education, but desire a middle-class lifestyle. They won't get one. Even those with higher education are struggling to find useful employment. Wages after inflation have fallen by 1.6% during this administration. Median family income is down to the level it was at in 1989. Actual participation in the workforce peaked in 1997. Obama's stimulus package was mostly squandered, bolstering up state and local government employment, those jobs whose pensions and benefits are driving cities and states to bankruptcy. You want more bad economic news? I got plenty. Long-term unemployed? Way up. Applications for disability income? Way up. It goes on. Not to worry, though. The Federal Reserve has announced a new stimulus program, QE3, which will bring our government's purchases of its own paper up to $85 billion a month. Buying your own paper is exactly as dumb an idea as it sounds, but nobody can think of anything else to do. With the Eurozone struggling and the Chinese economy losing altitude fast, we're heading into some economically interesting times. Oh, did I mention the fiscal cliff that we go over in January, as tax cuts expire and spending cuts kick in? No? You want to hear about that? You don't? Well, I don't blame you. I mean, higher taxes and less government spending? Who wants that? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Just a follow-up here on the Chicago teachers' strike. The Chicago Sun-Times newspaper on Tuesday ran a headline reading thus, quote, "Teachers' strike enters its third day with two sides kilometres apart," end quote. Say what? Kilometres? Or kilometres if you want to be fussy about it. Or for that matter, clicks for all you Vietnam vets. The phrase kilometres apart is actually in quotes in the headline. So who are they quoting? Why, Teachers Union President Karen Lewis. She of the $250,000 compensation package and the activist left paper trail. I could be making a mountain out of a molehill here. Perhaps influenced by news pictures of the mountainous Ms. Lewis, who carries at least a pound of avoirdupois for every $1,000 of her compensation package. But would it be too much of a stretch to surmise that when you've been a lifelong left activist like this lady, stale old American miles, pounds and gallons have to give way to glamorous European, not to mention Soviet, kilometres, kilos and litres. And look at it from Ms. Lewis's point of view. In kilograms, she only weighs 120. item. This item is actually 2 weeks old, but I somehow never had room for it in previous broadcasts. It concerns 82-year-old Doris Thompson of Torrance, Colorado. Ms. Thompson is in a spot of bother over there in the Centennial State. She's been arrested for burglary. Her modus operandi was to go to a doctor's office, hide out till everyone had left, then search around for keys, open lockboxes and remove cash. It was a nice little earner. She is said to have netted $17,000 since March. Not quite in the Chicago public school teacher range of income, but not bad for an 82-year-old with, one presumes, few material wants. Miss Thompson has been doing this kind of thing for a while. Her rap sheet, which fills 21 pages, goes back to 1955. Charges include disturbing the peace, burglary, forgery and grand theft. In 1957, when she was just 27 years old, she was arrested in connection with a homicide, but declared insane and committed to an asylum. Okay, here's the punchline. On her previous arrest 2 years ago, Ms. Thompson told police detectives that she, quote, wouldn't do all this nonsense if the government gave us more money. Now that is an Obama voter speaking. Item, I don't believe that Radio Durb, in all our years of broadcasting, has ever run a story about gynecomastia. That's the medical term for man boobs. Gynecomastia. Well, here's a story on that very topic. It concerns King Tutankhamun of Egypt, who died tragically young, he was only 18 or 19, about 3,300 years ago. His tomb was discovered in a remarkably well-preserved condition in 1922. It turns out that King Tutankhamun had man boobs. That's not a normal thing to have at 18 or 19. But a British medical researcher has come up with an explanation. The researcher, one Dr. Ashrafian, suggests that Tutankhamun suffered from a rare brain disorder that does indeed have gynecomastia as one of its side effects. King Tut also had religious visions and hallucinations, another known side effect. It's the man boobs that naturally hold one's attention, though. Just think, for 90 years we've been calling him King Tut, when the name should have been plural, and with a different vowel. On that deplorably low note, ladies and gentlemen, I leave you. In the absence of any particular musical themes in this week's broadcast, my faithful friend, Franz Joseph Haydn, will see us out with one of his Derbyshire marches. More from Radio Durb next week. Over to you, Franz.